This clustering together extends to the astronomical dimension also. Planets cluster together, stars cluster together, even galactic structures cluster together, clusters of galaxies. There are even clusters of galaxies, superclusters. There is no randomness in terms of structure on any level of the universe. It is all exactly, truthfully, in a discoverable form. Incidentally, this is esoteric, but quite useful if you're meditating on it. It means that the formlessness of the universe is also very constantly recognizable in its thusness. What is not there is precisely not there everywhere. Is that? I hope that makes sense. If it does, you can see this is a tremendously powerful meditation. Tremendously powerful meditation. When you work on this level, you're not being provincial in terms of this star system anymore. Whatever you discover there is viable wherever you might be, in whatever galactic structure you happen to discover yourself. This is information that won't go out of date. But notice now the genius of the Chinese, coming back. The genius of the Chinese is that the polarity aspect of the transformational process is always a potential but never actually occurs. What actually occurs is the jump from discrete energy quanta to the next. And it's only because of an ideational filter that you're focusing on one of the calibrations and not the others. It's because of your filtering it, and not because the universe is not working in all that full, is working in a full range all the time. The most brilliant statement of this is in Spinoza. Spinoza's mystical geometry is the most beautiful expression of this. I don't know if you're following this or not, but in Israel, there's a big thing, there's a book on Spinoza that's a bestseller now because there's a problem of people in Israel trying to find out what is a Jew. Well, how can all these people be Jews? Well, I thought Judaism was this. And there's a tremendous spectrum, and secular, so-called secular Judaism is saying, well, now Spinoza is very accurate about the relationship of man to God. Anyway, in Spinoza is a very accurate understanding of this. For the Chinese Taoist, since we're always filtering, to put us in a non-filtering mode would mean that we have, and which we can do incidentally, it means though that we have no mind. We have a condition of no mind, the no mind condition. Chinese call it Wu Wei. No mind. So that there's no cognitive screening going on at all. And because that's exactly what is happening, that the screening is not going on, nothing registers at all. Nothing at all. Or you can put it the other way around, nothing registers. Nothing does register. For the Chinese Taoists who were just supersonic about this, they would grin and say, I'm doing nothing. I'm doing exactly nothing. Or they would put it in a nice little homey way. They'd say, well, I'm drifting like the clouds. Basho, when he begins the Hoso Michi, he says, all day long the white clouds drift by. And he's showing us that he's beginning at absolute zero. He's Zen-like, just with those, he is those drifting clouds. He's not anything in particular himself. That filterless condition is not able to be symbolically used. There is no psychic energy. It's like at the pivot where there's no psychic energy whatsoever. But as soon as there is a psychic energy, one's using a filter. So the Chinese get around this by saying, the filter that we want to use, since we have to use one, we'll use the filter of the fulcrum of the transformation process. Since if we're in the Tao, we're in the Tao, and there's nothing happening. But we want to be in the psychic energy transformation process, and since we have to choose one of the calibrations, let's choose the center calibration, the center of the transformation process. And what is that? That's the point where the yang is in between the two yin, or the place where the yin is in between the two yang. Now notice how alchemical the Chinese civilized soul is. When you have the written expression of the yang in between two yin, in the I Ching, that's said to be water. And when you have the yin in between two yang, that's said to be fire. Fire and water are the two universal solvents for all matter. And in a natural sense, it's very true. But fire and water are related to each other in a very arcane but exact way. They are able to accurately displace each other in the phase continuum of the transformation processes. The yin in between two yang is able to operate in yang's transformational continuum as if it were its opposite. And the same for fire and water are able to exchange themselves, so that when you have the Taoist symbol, the Tai Chi, you have that circle of light in the dark and the circle of dark in the light. That's fire and water. Those are fire and water. It shows that if you're going to use your psychic energy in a human way, this is the symbol of the comprehensive truth of what is happening. No matter what you are doing in detail, this is what is happening in actuality. This is a way of symbolizing what is actually happening. It may take you a while to affinitize yourself to linking the symbol to what the activity, but it's a translation problem, and it's not a quandary. It's not a philosophic problem. It's an activity affinitizer. So that for the Chinese psyche and the Japanese psyche, East Asian psyche, there's no possibility for thought to outstrip life action, because as soon as you do, you fall into an imbalance. As soon as you do, you fall into an imbalance. And if you're using this particular screen, this particular energy quantification, the exchange point, which is part of the Tai Chi, this is the basic context in which all events are occurring. What is that then? That is said in the I Ching. That is the human realm. That is where man is. That is where man is. Man becomes the bridge between heaven as the Tao and the earth as the 10,000 thing. Man is the bridge between them. That's the self of man. That's the mind of man. The mind of man is in that third position, that third place in the five-phase cycle. But the true definition of man is to see that he occurs, I occur, you occur, objectively, in a flow of transformational media, which are distinctly different on a subtle level, but are related in so many ways that they seem to form a ribbon, a stream of consciousness. So that the phrase is, we are a momentary island in a stream of consciousness. But the consciousness that has flowed by us has a kind of a wake to it. And the consciousness that has not yet flowed by us has a kind of a pure stream. Depending on your orientation in the world, your psychic energy will have that rippling effect. And if it does, then your imagination will be that pure stream, or the other way around. If your imagination has that rippling, your psychic energy will have that pure quality. They're related together. They seem like they're the same thing. It's all consciousness. But it's not so. There is a subtle, distinct difference. It's the self on that arcane level that makes that difference. Without self-knowledge, without self-realization, one would never know this. It would simply not occur to one at all that this was even possible. Notice here that what is traditionally called magic is related to mythology. The mythology is the image base, is the imaginal realm. Imagination is the transformational media of the mythic horizon. And myth and magic are related because they are the context in which the self occurs. They're the context in which the symbolic focus, the self, the symbolic self occurs in a stream of consciousness, which is like magic and myth together. The way in which that happens socially for man is that I exist in the stream of the language capacity which I have. The communicative modes which distinguish my workings are where I occur most precisely. So that one can say, and I'll conclude with this and we'll have a break, one can say very accurately that we exist as precisely as we are able to speak. This is the arcane power of the word. This is the true abracadabra. The word, the language that you use, is the most accurate calibrating media for where you actually occur. So it becomes extremely important for you to, if you want to grow in your consciousness, in your self-realization, that you have to expand your language capability. I don't mean learning foreign languages. I mean learn to use whatever language modes you have more and more completely. In other words, it's like the popular saying, if you want to get out of your isolate smallness, you have to learn new communication skills. Well, yeah, that's right. It's easy to say. But you can see that it's very arcane and very technically difficult to do this. And as one raises consciousness, as you would say, as one expands one's, amplifies one's capacity for language, the psychic energy goes up. And also your imagination goes up. A much more powerful imagination, much more powerful psychic energy. So that one of the images in the 17th century of someone who self-realized, Robert Fludd, an English alchemist, drew a beautiful human head with a ray, imaginative ray, coming out of a third eye in the forehead. The power of imagination carried on psychic energy. And it was like a early 17th century symbolic expression of what happens flood was not learned enough, and it was not arcane enough to show that the eye has no image in it. And consequently, it came to be that whatever the rays that were coming out, that the inner eye would see the rays, doesn't see the rays at all. There are no rays. The rays occur, but the inner eye doesn't see them. The Tibetan Vajrayana formulation is more accurate. They use the term clear light. It doesn't have colors, and it isn't white either, but it's clear, or no light, as you would say. When one sees by that light, one sees in terms of the real self. You see what is here, but you see it in its wholeness. One person put it very aptly, you yourself become transparent. You're quite conscious that you're here, but you're also conscious that you're transparent. You're not in the way. The filter that you're having to use by using your mind in this world is there, but it's transparent. Clear, if one would say. But you can see that there's an infinite number of ways to misunderstand this, to not know what one is saying. Let's take a break. I want to show you how difficult it is to work with this material on this level. And you can't really blame people that drop out or fall by the wayside or who lose confidence or lose energy. There's no blame. It's really hard. For instance, I want to show you how inaccurate Carl Jung was in some very crucial areas which he spent a whole lifetime in. Clearly, there's nothing wrong with Jung's mind, intellectually. Nothing wrong with his character. This is from the book that you're reading, I hope you're reading, Alchemical Studies, Volume 13. This is from his essay on the philosophical tree. This is page 273. And I'll read Jung's page to you and then try and show you, or perhaps you can see it for yourself, how a predisposed intellectual paradigm interferes with Jung's ability to recognize the flow process, the transformational process. This characterization is the deposit of many years of research into the statements of individual patients. Even the layman reading this essay will be struck by the amount of material from fairy tale, myth, and poetry that appears in the illustrations. In this connection, it is astonishing how relatively seldom the persons I interrogated were conscious of sources of this kind. The main reasons for this are, I guess, three reasons. One, in general, people think little, if at all, about the origins of dream images and still less about myth motifs. What's the human tendency? To think about the dream images. What about the origins of the dream images? Where do they come from? If you're worried about what the dream means, where is it coming from? And notice that the corollary question to where is it coming from is where is it going to? Notice that the dream image occurs in a transformational continuum, coming from somewhere, going somewhere, and there's no way in the world that you know what those images are. There's no dictionaries that are trustworthy. You have to be able to understand that those images are occurring, coming from somewhere, going to somewhere. Their meaning is all realistically in that. Anything else is just speculation. Beer talk. Why is psychiatry just effective 50% of the time? Because it's most of it's beer talk. But if you're your own problem, then you cut the crap out. Then you know that you've got to do something. And you get interested then. Well, why is this happening? Well, where is this coming from? So Jung says, in general, people think little, if at all, about the origins of dream images, and still less about myth motifs. The myth motifs. A motif is a structural phrase of imagery. The myth motif is not only a structure in mythology, but that structure in mythology is a structure of the dream imagery also. The oldest living human group on the planet are the Australian Aborigines. And their mythologies are from the dream time. They're very accurate. The myths and the dreams. These are the pythons of our time. The myths and the dreams have a similar structure. What is the structure? The structure is the motif. The motif carries forward a feeling tone which in the expression of the dream and the myth becomes an image carrying not only feeling but meaning developing out of the feeling. Where is the meaning going? The meaning is going to the self. There's only one destination for all of the dream images, no matter what they are, and that's for the self. All the planes are leaving for the self. All the trains are going to the self. All the buses arriving read self. They tend to interiorize and go together. They tend to go to the center. So that their whole purpose, if you will, is all bound up in the way in which integration happens. The very essence of what feeling is to bring it together. And complementary to that, thought is the other side of that. The thought is differentiation. Separating it out. So that you get into a real bind if you try to force an integral pattern upon thought without any feeling tone to help it along. That can drive you crazy. And what happens, of course, is that because you're trying to force this, your imagination will project something in fantasy out and give you a fantasy integration. Not true at all, but you keep demanding something. Here, how about this? That's the world of illusion. That's Maya. And almost everyone lives in that realm. and nothing happens in that realm except the story goes on. Imagination feeds it, and the self gets lost. Loss of self. Second, we're back to Jung. And the second is what we've just been talking about. The sources have been forgotten. Forgotten. Not only have you forgotten where these come from, or that there is even some place that they come from. What is the place they come from? That integral flow of feeling towards meaning, towards self. But even the sources have been forgotten, not only the origins, but the self itself. The destination, which is a source also. The purpose and the origins are both sources. Founts, if you like. They've been forgotten. So characteristically, the images then seem to occur, really they shine and hypnotize us, and we think, oh well, it's the images that are objective. The images are not objective at all. They're just occurrences in a transformational medium. You say, oh well, I can have a very clear image in my mind. Well, the mind can entertain transformational media very well. That's what its whole function is to do that. Oh, well, I can draw those images out. Well, that's right. The drawings are quite real, quite objective. That's the art of person-making is all involved in that, and we'll get to that. The sources have been forgotten, and three, the sources were never in any sense conscious. That is to say, the images are new archetypal creations. And here Jung is out in left field. Because of a presuppositional paradigm that he's carrying in his own mind at this time. This is in the philosophic tree. The sources were never in any sense conscious. That is to say, the images are new archetypal creations. They are new archetypal creations if they're retrogressively projected back and you've forgotten about the self, then they seem new. But to write this out is if that were the case, if that were a structural trustworthy designation of them, is not only incorrect and fallacious, but misleading. But he goes on with this third possibility. He has a whole new paragraph now. He's going to underscore the problem. The third possibility is much less rare than one might suppose. On the contrary, it occurs so frequently that comparative research into symbols becomes unavoidable in elucidating the spontaneous products of the unconscious. Now notice the phrase here, the spontaneous products of the unconscious. This is already loading your mouth with all kinds of presuppositional and even yet diagrammatic concepts which are highly problematical, at least highly problematical. A Taoist would never be able to bring himself to this point of ideational pride. The Tao is spontaneous, but man's mind is pretty far along in that transformational process where the Tao has become the one and the one has become the two, and at that point, well, you're kind of hard-pressed to say that it's spontaneous. What is spontaneous in the Tao is no longer even spontaneous in the one, which is nature, much less spontaneous in the mind. The mind... In other words, if you don't know about the origins, you don't know about the purposes, You don't understand the ecological reality of the situation to say that spontaneous out of the unconscious, you're assuming all kinds of things that frankly just don't occur. So much so that when Jung tries to take this conceptual viewpoint and put it onto the Chinese experience, he comes out by writing saying, well, the Chinese don't have any unconscious. I think I've read at least three times here that statement from Jung in his volume of letters. Well, the Chinese and Japanese don't have any unconscious. What does this do to the universality, then, of your model? You see, there are all kinds of problems. And if you don't make that conscious to yourself, what kinds of social and political derivations are you making from those kinds of suppositions? What kind of illusionary polarities are you making up that then you live by, and thus the world becomes a standoff east against west? It's a very, very precarious and perilous enterprise, this. Let's read on. The widely held view that mythologems, or myth motifs, and he has a note here, including figures of speech. Figures of speech is a wonderful phrase. Notice how natural the phrase is, figures of speech. That means the shapes that speech and its movement configure. Those are the figures of speech. What are they? They are phrases which become allegorical. There's a very special kind of a quality here. The widely held view, writes Uncle Carl, that mythologems or myth motifs are always connected with a tradition prove untenable. And now he's tearing the connection between ritual and myth, or between dream and tradition, or between the development of a culture and the personal experience. He's breaking a fundamental tie that unless it is there, there is no way that anyone can understand anything without bringing illusion in by the bushel basket. You're setting yourself up at this point for juggling alternative illusions and then expecting the mind to pick out, well, what is the most likely? And this is exactly what's happened in the 20th century. In the 20th century, science, which should know better, bases itself on a probability and not on a certainty at all. Almost everything that is done now is done with probability. The very bad worldly illusion. The greatest author of the greatest tract on probability was John Maynard Keynes, who's responsible for a lot of economic crap also. Pardon me. Don't get me started. The widely held view that mythologems or myth motifs are always connected with a tradition proves untenable, since they may reappear anywhere at any time and in any individual regardless of tradition. This particular phrase, which contains a very powerful idea, which has a mask of illusion covering it, has become one of the most destructive ideas of our time. This phrase has destroyed more human happiness than any kind of Nazi or Stalinist propaganda. it's saying that the unconscious, since it's unknowable and spontaneously acts without any kind of a base or rationality whatsoever, in a Russian roulette way, throws up images that can occur in anybody, any place, and so there is no orientation that makes any sense, and all is relative, and all values must then be pegged to this kind of Russian roulette activity. Now this is sheer shit. This is nothing but problems. For one thing, it's engendered a tone in the world today for people to junk their own traditions. Those people knew nothing. They didn't have no machines, and they didn't have what we have. They were old, not only old-fashioned, but they're completely out of date. See? Now you can't junk the traditions. You can't junk the heritage of man and think that you're going to live much beyond your cleverness. The range of your cleverness then is the only guarantee that you have, that you're going to make it. But also it tears the fundamental tie of human cultures and societies with nature. Because ritual is the objective linking of man with nature. It's like breaking this sentence, this idea, is like breaking the DNA chain and introducing a wide open space for any kind of a genetic mutation. You don't know what it's going to be. It's like Gaia's famous illustration, the sleep of reason produces monsters. When you anesthetize yourself with this kind of a false ideation that there's no real tie with nature, there's no real tie with tradition, that overpowering, compulsive, powerful images come up spontaneously from your unconscious. You don't know where they come up from, but they come up in everybody. So everybody is in the same stew of not knowing a thing. This is a very, very destructive, false view of life and of man. And it's an idea which has become so pervasive and popular today that you hear kids on the street corner mimicking echoes of this perspective. And you find so-called New Age gurus just raking it in left and right, lecturing to thousands of people, hopping from place to place, whipping up little souffles of speculation on the basis of this so-called freedom. Well, it's all relative. This is a very dangerous idea. Jung never meant it to be dangerous. He never really understood what is packed up here in this kind of an idea. A real, real, real problem. Does it surprise you that even someone as conscious as Jung would be unknowing a very potent area of himself? Believe me, almost all of us have blind spots, and the conscious thing is to understand that it's always possible. And one of the whole basis of community and of being companions together is to rely on the fact that if enough of us are conscious at enough level, we're going to reduce the possibility of letting a blind spot run away with us. It's one of the very rationales of human society, of human community. Why do we band together? Not just simply because we're more powerful, because there is an existential conscious realization that we're all carrying more or less some capacity for blindness, but together we reduce that compulsive blindness's range of control over any one of us. This is the whole basis of democracy, incidentally. It's a brilliant idea, first conceived poignantly in the 5th century in Athens, because they faced this problem. They found that even the best of us is blind. It's the whole basis of Greek tragedy, is to show that even the best of the human beings, fully energized, still carries a blind capacity, because you can't see into your own self. You can, but when you do, there's no image there. And if you don't know that, if you don't have that double consciousness, you think you can fill it with whatever suggests itself to you as best. The classic 20th century statement of the abstract structure of this was in Jean-Paul Sartre's essay, The Whole, in Being and Nothingness. And if some of you are philosophically astute, you can go get the tome of Being and Nothingness, and you can go right to the heart of Being and Nothingness, the essay called The Whole, which later in life Sartre completely repudiated his work. In a book called The Critique of Dialectical Reason, and he went off onto another tangent, but came to understand that he had not understood the situation at all. It's a breaking point for 20th century thought that bases itself on a kind of eidetic reduction. I'm speaking philosophically now because it's the only way to speak about this subject area. Here's the idea again. The widely held view that mythologems or myth motifs are always connected with a tradition proves untenable, since they may reappear anywhere at any time and in any individual, regardless of tradition. Then he goes on. An image can be considered archetypal when it can be shown to exist in the records of human history in identical form and with the same meaning. Two extremes must be distinguished here. One, the image is clearly defined and is consciously connected with a tradition. Two, the image is without doubt autosynthonous, there being no possibility, let alone probability, of a tradition. Every degree of mutual contamination may be found between these two extremes. The image is clearly defined, is consciously connected with a tradition. The image is, without doubt, autosynthonous, there being no possibility, let alone probability, of a tradition. Now, out of this, where does this come from in you? This comes out of his young manhood, out of his concern with occult experience. This idea, in one mode of its development, was the idea of synchronicity, a causal connectedness, putting in one boat that causal connectedness is like images that come out of tradition, and putting into a causal connectedness, into synchronicity, spontaneous images from the unconscious. I won't even say it. The next sentence isn't a telling sentence. We'll wait for the machines to